Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. There is much we don't understand about the human brain, but what we're learning upends some of what we thought we knew. For example, who we are as individuals is not a question of nature versus nurture. And did you realize our brains are busy predicting what will happen rather than reacting to what is happening? What we're learning about the brain isn't merely interesting. It could help us address some of society's most pressing problems, such as inequity, racism, and even climate change. Joining us is Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a neuroscientist and a university distinguished professor at Northeastern with research appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. Her most recent book is titled Seven and a Half Lessons About the Brain. Dr. Barrett, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
The first lesson in your book is that the brain is not for thinking. So what is the role of the brain?
Well, if we look back a very, very long time ago into the evolutionary past, we can look to a time when, you know, animals didn't have brains and look at how scientists believe that brains evolved. And when we do this, what we discover is that your brain's most important job isn't thinking or feeling or even seeing. It's regulating the systems of your body. You have many, many systems inside your body. They all need oxygen, water, glucose, and so on to be able to keep healthy and do their job. And so you can think about your brain as the financial center of a large international, multinational corporation, kind of budgeting, running a budget for your body.
So you say our brains have evolved. So what our brains do now hasn't always been the case?
No, I think it's that the way to think about it is that your brain does many things. And when brains evolved on the evolutionary scene, when they emerged on the evolutionary scene, a whole set of other systems in the body emerged. So animals, before animals had brains, they also didn't have very complicated internal systems. They had no eyes, they had no ears, they had no ability to smell. They had no senses, no way of sensing in any complicated way the outside world. They didn't have lungs or hearts or internal organs. All of these things seem to evolve approximately at the same time. As animals started to hunt each other and have to make decisions about when to move and how quickly to move, they also developed brains. And so at the core of the human brain, you can see the circuitry that's important for memory, that's important for language, that's important for many of the things that we think of as quintessentially human, are also regulating your body on a moment-to-moment basis. So they're doing, most brain regions are doing more than one thing at the same time. And a core thing they're doing is regulating the systems of your body to keep you alive and well.
So do we know if the brains of other mammals function similarly to the human brain?
Yes, they do. So it's really surprising that, you know, for many, many years, scientists believed that brains evolved in kind of an upward trajectory so that lizard brains could, you know, do instincts, had circuitry for instincts, and mammals, when mammals evolved, layered on top of that was other parts of the brain for emotion, and then when humans evolved, layered on top of that was parts of the brain for rationality. And if you look at all sorts of mammal brains, mammalian brains, to the naked eye, they have some similarity, but they also look somewhat different from each other. What's really interesting, though, is that when you peer deep into the molecular structure of the cells that make up the brain, what we can see is that all mammal brains, and even all brains of vertebrates, animals with backbones, actually have the same sorts of neurons. And so there are really no new parts in any mammalian brain. And in fact, research now shows that all mammal brains are built according to the same manufacturing plan, whether we're talking about a rat or a dog or a whale or a human. All of the brains that have ever been studied developmentally, the developmental stages, the developmental stages are the same. What differs is how long the stages run for, and that's what makes these apparent differences in brain structure.
That's really fascinating when you think about it. You know, you look at like the intelligence of something like a rat. It makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it turns out that, we're used to thinking of ourselves as really remarkable creatures compared to all the other creatures on Earth. And but, you know, other animals are pretty remarkable in their own way. So, for example, rats are really interesting animals. They leave markers, chemical markers, for their litter mates to indicate what's safe to eat and what's not safe to eat. They're communicating in ways that humans are largely unaware of. And there are some pretty remarkable brains on this planet in animals that can do pretty remarkable things that we can't do, and in fact that we endow our superheroes with, you know, these abilities that other animals have. So this is not to say that humans aren't remarkable too. We certainly can do many things that other animals can't do, but there are lots of incredibly cool and really remarkable animal brains on this planet.
Right. So is there such a thing as intuition?
Well, that's a hard question to answer in a sense, because, different cultures of humans have different ways of understanding their own mental lives. Mm. And so in our culture, we certainly experience the gut feelings and the thoughts that come to us automatically that our brain makes kind of without a feeling of intention. We experience that as intuition. And you can think about intuition as it's a feeling or a thought that your brain is making based on past experience, based on sequences of patterns that your brain has learned in the past. And your brain is constantly using the present to make predictions about what's going to happen next. And some of those we experience as intuition.
Yeah, I think that's a surprising thing a lot of people find, is that we've learned that the brain isn't reactive, it's predictive. And I don't think we think of our brains in that way, right?
Well, we don't experience the world that way. I don't know about you, Mindy, but I certainly don't. I don't experience myself as constantly predicting what's going to happen next. Frankly, over the past couple of months, my main feeling has been one of uncertainty and constantly feeling like I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Right.
And I think a lot of people have that feeling. But actually, under the hood, if we look at the structure of the brain, if we look at the brain's how the brain performs metabolism, so the metabolics of the brain, if we look at the energy properties of the brain, and we even look at the function of the brain, what we can see from hundreds and hundreds of studies is that brains are not reacting to what's happening in the world. They're predicting. They're busy predicting what's going to happen in a moment from now. And one really interesting example of this, which I find really fascinating, is just something simple like taking a drink of water when you're thirsty. If you think about the last time you were thirsty and you drank a glass of water, within a few seconds, your thirst was quenched. And this is really remarkable because the water that you drink doesn't actually reach your bloodstream for about 20 minutes. So how can water quench your thirst so quickly? And the answer is because your brain has learned from experience in the past of drinking water, has learned again and again and again that it makes you less thirsty. So as your brain is preparing and allowing you to drink and swallow, it's actually quenching your thirst. It's reducing the feeling of thirst. 20 minutes later, this prediction becomes your experience.
Yeah. So how does a productive brain work with babies and young children who haven't accumulated much data for the brain to work with?
Yeah, so they are actually building the experience to be able to predict. So one way that scientists refer to this predictive machinery is an internal model, that your brain has an internal model of your body in the world. So it's constantly it's making predictions about what's going to happen in your body a moment from now, what's going to happen outside in the world a moment from now based on past experience. And this is your internal model of your body in the world. Babies don't have much of an internal model. They're not born like a blank slate. They certainly have some ability, the brains of babies have some ability, very, very small ability to predict. But they're learning all the time. And that's what learning is. Learning is when your brain is unable to predict something, there's information coming from the body or coming from the world that your brain didn't predict and your brain takes it in. That's what we call learning. And so babies are constantly learning. They're slowly building that internal model of their bodies in the world. And you, as a caregiver, are cultivating, are curating a world that will wire your baby's brain.
Yeah, it's almost like stimulus overload. And you think about like a young child, they're just constantly all the questions and, you know, they're like little sponges just soaking up every little bit of information that they can get their hands on.
They are like little sponges. And what's really interesting is that, of course, we knew this for a long time, but I don't think we really knew the extent to which an infant brain was really born under construction. So little brains wire themselves to their world. They wire themselves to their physical world. So, for example, babies are born with their visual systems unfinished and their auditory systems unfinished. So if a baby's brain is not stimulated with light that will hit the baby's eye, the retina of the eye, and make its way to the brain, then the brain doesn't finish wiring itself to be able to see normally. And this is true for most senses. But it's also the case that the baby's brain wires itself to its social world, meaning when you take care of a baby, when you feed a baby, when you hug a baby, when you sing to a baby, talk to a baby, play with a baby, teach the baby to sleep, when to sleep, and so on, what you're doing really is you're providing wiring instructions for that baby's brain. And, you know, it's true that babies' brains are like little sponges, but we actually can't learn everything that's available to us.
Right.
That would be information overload. And so a lot of what we're doing with our infants, with gaze, how we match their gaze, they look at something, we look at something, we look back at them, we label things for them, we point things out to them, and we also don't respond to some sounds, and we don't label some actions. What we're really doing is we're basically teaching children, you know, pay attention to this. This is really important for your internal model. You can ignore this. This is really not important.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Feldman-Barrett. Her book is 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Lisa Feldman-Barrett, neuroscientist and a university distinguished professor at Northeastern, with research appointments at Harvard Medical School and Mass General Hospital. Her book is 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So people with memory loss can't access certain information, but do we know if that information is still influencing how their brain is responding?
Well, memory loss is a label that refers to lots of different types of problems. I think the basic rule is something like this. If the memory loss stems from the loss of neurons, then like dementia, then the memory loss is permanent. And the information that was once available is no longer available anymore. If the memory loss is due to some other cause, then it's possible that the brain can still, that the information is still available in some way. I think it's important, Mindy, to remember that, or to learn that memory, we don't retrieve memories. Memories aren't like files that are in a file drawer that we can just pull up whenever we want. Memory isn't stored in the brain, really. Instead, the way to think about it is that there are billions of neurons working together, talking to each other, passing information back and forth, and what they're doing is reinstating memory. They are reassembling a past experience in the present, and that's what a memory is. So if you lose neurons, that is, the neurons die, that's in most parts of a human brain, that's a permanent condition. Yeah. And the memories, the information that those neurons were involved in making won't come back.
You're making a good point, too, about it not being stored like a file. It explains why siblings may remember some childhood event differently, right? Because we may not remember exactly, it's not like this exact photo, if you will, experience in our brains of what happened.
Exactly. I think it's really important to realize that every experience you have, every action you take, is some combination of what's inside your head and what's outside in the world. So to us, it feels like we're viewing the world like a camera, but that's not at all what's happening under the hood. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you had no prior experience at all that your brain could bring to bear in the current moment to help you understand the visual sensations, you would be what's called experientially blind. It would be like hearing a language that you can't speak. It would be just like noise. You wouldn't be able to make sense of it at all.
Yeah. How can what we're learning about the brain help us better understand behavioral or cognitive disorders such as autism spectrum disorder or ADHD?
Well, right now there's an emerging consensus about autism spectrum disorders that there's a difference in how these brains, the brains of people on the spectrum, are using past experience to predict. So in a neurotypical brain, this predictive power is something that is very, very automatic. And in fact, it's so automatic that we can't stop it very easily when we want to. So things like memory and things like imagination and experiences like rumination and mind wandering are all a result of a predicting brain. The process underneath is exactly the same, even though we give different names to these things. So because we have a brain neurotypically that is so competent at mental time travel, we can remember the past, we can experience and imagine the future, we have sometimes a hard time staying in the present. Mm-hmm. A brain on the spectrum is a brain that is not so well equipped to automatically predict. And as a consequence, people who have brains on the spectrum, who are diagnosed as being on the spectrum, their brains also are not so efficient at regulating their bodies. And so, for example, people used to believe that folks who were diagnosed with autism were not interested in social interaction and would shy away from interacting with other people and would, you know, look calm one minute and fly off the handle in the next minute, or would engage in repetitious behaviors that seemed inexplicable. But you can think of all of these things as resulting from a brain that doesn't predict very easily or very fluidly the way that a neurotypical brain does. People who are on the spectrum often have tremendous anxiety because their brains have a lot of trouble predicting in social situations where things are often ambiguous or uncertain because, you know, a smile or the raise of an eyebrow or even a couple of words can have very, very different meanings depending on the context. And a neurotypical brain can deal with that very easily, whereas a brain on the spectrum has a lot more challenge.
Yeah. And what about ADHD? I'm thinking, you know, children with ADHD, they just have so much going on. A lot of them say they just can't even like fall asleep at night because there's so much happening in their brain at once. And they are so in tune to sounds that might be in the background to us that are, you know, just front and center with them.
Yeah, so a way to think about it is that your brain isn't only predicting what's going to happen next. It's also predicting the likelihood of importance. So, for example, right now, there's information that's available to your brain that your brain is predicting and that you're experiencing, but that you're not really, it's not really in the foreground of your attention. But the minute that I mention it, it will be. So
yeah.
If you're sitting down, if your listeners are sitting, you are feeling the chair push up against the back of your legs or the chair push against the back, against your back. You can feel it, or the floor pushing against the feet, the bottom of your feet. You can feel it, and the minute I mention it, your attention is brought to it. But it wasn't really in the foreground of your attention before because your brain didn't really consider it that important for whatever you were going to do next. And this is what scientists call precision, or they call the reliability of importance of information. If it's not that, if your brain predicts it's not that important, it's not going to bring it into the foreground of attention. Part of the problem with that people are struggling with a diagnosis of ADHD is that that aspect of their brain, that the network that is involved in determining what's important, what's signal and what's noise, what's important and what can be ignored, is not working as well or as efficiently. Mm. And as a consequence, they have a really hard time figuring out what is a sensory signal that's important to predict and respond to, and what is really noise and can be safely ignored.
Mm. Makes sense. So if our actions are dependent on past experience, do we really control what we do?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Free will is a topic that philosophers have been debating forever, and so we're not going to, you know, settle it here on your show. And it's true that your brain is constantly predicting and launching your actions before you're aware of them. And this is why, you know, we have baseball and football, and that's how sports works. You know, we wouldn't have these sports if our brains weren't predictive. But there's another part to the story of free will that I think isn't explored very much, and that is that your brain predicts and launches your actions based on data from your past experience. And so one way of changing the present is to change the past. Now, we can't really reach back into our past and change what's happened. I mean, that's partly what we try to do in psychotherapy, but it's not really feasible, for the most part, to change your past. What you can do, though, is cultivate different experiences for yourself now with some effort, that is, learn something new, right, something you can't predict mm-hmm. now, as a way of seeding your brain to predict differently in the future. And that is a form of free will. In a matter of speaking, I think that's rarely discussed. You're continually cultivating your past as a means of controlling your future.
We're talking with Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her latest book is 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. If you have thoughts, comments, or questions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. If we construct the reality around us, including our emotions, does that mean we can change how we feel?
Yes and no. I mean, some parts are easier and some parts are harder. So your brain uses some ingredients, in a sense, to construct your emotions or how you feel. Your brain, as I said, is always controlling your body, and your body is always sending information back to your brain from the sensory changes in your heart beating and your lungs expanding and so on. And you don't experience those sensations directly very often. In fact, usually you only do when there's something wrong. Usually what you're feeling is a feeling of pleasantness or comfort, unpleasantness or discomfort, feeling worked up or feeling calm. These simple feelings that come from your body are called affect, or you might know them as mood. They're not emotions. They are the feelings that come from your brain's body budgeting, but brain controlling the systems of your body. And they're always with you, every waking moment of your life. Sometimes they're in the foreground of your attention, and sometimes they're in the background, but they're always there. Now, your brain will make those into emotions by using information from the past to predict the causes of those feelings. So what your brain is doing when it makes an emotion is really taking that feeling of comfort or that feeling of distress and connecting it to what's going on around you in the world by figuratively asking itself, like, the last time I felt this way and I was in a situation like this, what did I do next? Was this anger? Was this sadness? Was this fear? Was this awe? Was this gratitude? And so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so you can control those ingredients to some extent, but some of that is easier to do and some of it is much more challenging.
Yeah. We have a monthly behavioral health program and regularly talk about cognitive behavioral therapy and the idea of awareness or mindfulness. Is that one of the ways we can start to change how we feel and change the way our brain will predict what comes next?
Yes, exactly. So if we were to stop time right now and look at and, you know, peer into your brain to see what's going on, your brain would have it would be taking stock of what's going on in the world and what's going on in your body and making a prediction about what's going to happen next. So your predictions are driven largely by the environment and the external environment, meaning what's going on around you, and the internal environment, meaning what's going on inside your body. So it's important to realize that your body is a context that you carry around with you and you can't leave it at home. You know, it's always with you. And so when you want to change your context in order to change your predictions, change the stream of predictions, sometimes you can literally get up and move to a different situation, but sometimes you can't. And as I said, you can't ever really disconnect yourself from your body without pharmacological intervention, like without taking drugs.
Right. Yeah.
So what you can do is change what you pay attention to. Remember, we were talking about, you know, what signal and what's noise? What sensations is your brain going to pay attention to, and what can it safely ignore as noise? What mindfulness does is it lets you focus in on sensory details or ignore details. Gives you more control over what is the part of the context that is most relevant to you right now. And that is a really powerful way to be able to change the situation you're in, change your context without ever moving a muscle.
Seven and a Half Lessons About the Brain follows up your 2017 bestseller, How Emotions Are Made. And both books dig into the interactions between our brains, our actions, our emotions, and the physical world. Tell us more about the research that underpins these insights into how the brain works.
Well, the research comes from many, many, many different sources. So in our lab, we do research. We do brain imaging research where we put people inside a big magnet and we image what's going on inside their brains while we have them experience emotion or while they are viewing movies of their children or their very close people who are very close to them or strangers. But the research is also research on the structure and function of other animal brains. It's research that draws on the electrical functioning of neurons in the brain. The research that we do in my lab really spans multiple methods So we do brain imaging, but we also have people send people out into the world, and we can sense their heart rate changes, their blood pressure changes. We can sense their respiratory breathing changes. We can have some indication of where they're looking, and we use complex machine learning algorithms to try and understand the patterns that are driving, that can describe people's behavior. And it's a little bit like, you know, these apps that people use to track all these signals about themselves. We do something similar to that, but we try to build models that are describing an individual person's experience as it unfolds over time.
Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. This has made me think a lot about children that are unfortunate enough to be born into a family that has some mental disorders. And if they are infants and the parent is not relating the way they should, shall we say, can this be explain some mental disorders later on in life?
That's an excellent question, Janet. And I think what you're pointing to, the answer to your question is yes. We can't, it's very difficult to know the, to explain a mental difficulty on the basis of only genes or only experience, because we have the kind of nature that requires nurture. We have the kind of genes that require certain experiences in childhood in order to develop in a neurotypical way. And so, for example, children who are deprived of regular, consistent care from their caregivers, or children who are experience abuse, even outright abuse, that, remember, children's brains wire themselves to their world. That's the world that, that their brains are wiring themselves to. And when they become adults, they are unfortunately predisposed to difficulties because of the experiences that they had in childhood. And in fact, it seems now like very clear that the difficulties that they experience in childhood don't just predispose them to mental challenges, but also to physical disease. Physical diseases like diabetes, heart disease, even certain types of cancer. Metabolic diseases are more likely in children who've experienced adversity, especially young and in life.
Janet, thanks for the question. There's a lot of, it seems like, newer research about the effects of trauma, all types of trauma, right, on not only our mental health, but our physical health as well.
Yeah, so I think I prefer the word adversity because not all adverse experiences cause trauma, or I should say not everyone experiences trauma to an adverse experience, to an adverse event, and also some people are more likely to experience trauma than others, more generally speaking. So I think the way to think about it is that in general, when people... this is research by the psychologist George Bonanno. In general, when people are exposed to an adverse event, they will recover usually within a month to 6 months. They recover and move forward with their lives. But this is not necessarily true of children, particularly if the adversity is consistent over time. So children are resilient, but every time they experience an adverse event, every time they experience a neglect or a lack of responsiveness, they're basically paying a little metabolic tax. And that tax adds up over time to a major deficit. And when you run a deficit in your body budget, when your brain can't really control your body in a very efficient, metabolically efficient way, that sets you up to experience not only mental difficulties, but actually physical illnesses, because the metabolic basis of depression, of anxiety, of Alzheimer's disease is not that different from the metabolic basis of diabetes, heart disease, and certain types of cancer.
That's fascinating. I have Dr. Mark Whaley on the phone. Dr. Whaley's one of our regular guests on our monthly behavioral health programs, calling from Orleans. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Byron. First of all, thank you so much for being on the show and contributing such valuable information. It's you're particularly talented, and thank you again for being here. I wonder if you could give us some clues, or give us the latest or the best way you can explain it, information about what's called the hard question in psychology or neurology, is how the brain makes consciousness.
Mark, you just asked me the hardest question of all. So thank you for your comments. I appreciate that very much. The hard question is, in philosophy, actually, is the question of consciousness. Why are we sentient? Why are we aware of our experiences? And there is tremendous debate about this, as you know, Mark, certainly, maybe listeners too. But I think the an evolutionary perspective on the brain teaches us is that the brain's control of the body exists at many different levels of the brain, not just the cerebral cortex, but also levels below that, which are called subcortical, meaning under the cortex, the cerebral cortex. And particularly the parts of the brain which are important for controlling movement are parts of the brain that also are important to give you a sense of agency, that you are an agent in the world, that you move in a way that causes things to happen. And this is considered to be, by many neuroscientists and philosophers, a key aspect of being conscious of yourself as an object or an agent in the world. And there are some philosophers and neuroscientists who argue that this feeling of agency that, you know, when you, like, I'll just give you an example. When my daughter was about a month old, you know, she couldn't control her limbs very well, as most infants can't. But by accident, she knocked over a mobile, and the look on her face when her brain took in the information that a movement caused something to happen in the world. And for an hour almost, she tried really hard to do it again. She looked right at that mobile and tried to hit it. Of course, she had no control over her limbs, so she really couldn't do it very well. But that moment when an infant makes a movement and there's some sensory consequence to that movement in the world that the infant can detect, that's the first moment of self-awareness, of being a conscious agent in the world. And there's some indication that this is happening at multiple levels of the brain, but all the way down into subcortical regions. There's a particular region called the superior colliculus in the human brain, which is it's called the tectum in a reptile brain. And this is one of the first places where information about the internal state of the body and motor plans that the brain is making to move the body are integrated with sense changes that are coming from outside the world. We don't have a whole answer to the hard problem, but a partial answer is that is lurking in understanding how it is that our brain puts together motor plans for actions in the world and the sense data that come from those actions.
Thanks for the question, Mark. We're talking with Dr. Lisa Feldman-Barrett. She's a neuroscientist and author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Lisa Feldman-Barrett, neuroscientist and author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. You talk about the power of words in your book. Why do words affect our bodies and brains?
Well, words affect our bodies and brains because the parts of our brains that are important for processing words, that allow us to understand words and speak words, directly control our nervous system, directly control our cardiovascular system for our hearts, for our heart, our respiratory system, for our lungs. It directly controls our immune system and our metabolism.
Many people have been feeling anxiety and stress. You talked about it yourself, brought on by the coronavirus. How can our understanding of brain function help us with these feelings?
I think it's important to understand that when your brain can't predict something well, when your brain is attempting to make a prediction and it can't predict well, it's going to attempt to learn something new to help predict better in the future. And one thing it does is it releases chemicals that will improve learning, which also raises your arousal level. So I'm not talking about sexual arousal here. I'm talking here about feeling jittery, feeling on edge. And a lot of feeling jittery and on edge, immediately in our culture, our brains go to making anxiety, making fear. But actually, you know, what your brain is doing is attempting to learn something new because there's uncertainty. And this feels unpleasant because uncertainty is more metabolically costly. When your brain is predicting easily and well, that's just cheaper metabolically than trying to learn something new. The two most expensive things your brain can do is learn something new and move your body. So you don't always have to make anxiety out of this really jittery, unpleasant feeling. You could understand it simply as there's uncertainty here and that feels uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And this is not just, you know, a Jedi mind trick with words, right? It's important because the information that your brain brings to bear, the predictions that your brain makes, are predictions not only about what sense data mean, but what to do about them. And so if you experience anxiety, if your brain conjures anxiety out of these jittery feelings, then you're going to do something different than if you understand them merely as a physical consequence of uncertainty. Similarly, I keep referring to your brain running a budget for your body. I haven't really explained that metaphor completely. But if you think about how a budget works, when you're running a deficit in your financial budget, you usually slow your spending. This is what your brain also does. And remember what I said, when you're running a body budgeting deficit because of stress, which just means your brain is preparing your body for a big metabolic outlay, whether it comes or not. If you keep doing this over and over, and you don't sleep enough, and you don't, you know, eat healthfully, and you don't get enough exercise, and you don't have enough social contact, your brain is going to start running a budget deficit. And what does your brain do? It does the same thing as you do with a financial budget. It stops spending. And so what that means is you'll stop moving, and you'll stop learning. And you will feel like crap. So one way to think about what's happening to people right now is that we're all experiencing body budgeting deficits. Mm-hmm. And this is causing us to feel pretty miserable and also not to predict so well because we're not really adjusting and learning to changing circumstances as easily. And that can cause anxiety or cause arousal. So one thing to do, which I know sounds really crazy, but actually really works if you practice, is to try to understand the physical basis of what you're experiencing and not mentalize it into an emotion. Now, I want to be really clear here that when someone is suffering from a serious anxiety disorder or depression, as a like major depressive episode, this kind of reconceptualization, this like making meaning of your sensations in a different way, is not going to solve the problem. But what it can do is it can prevent you from getting to that point if you catch it early enough. And as you are recovering from disease, often with the help of medication, this kind of flexibility in making meaning of your sensations and your affective feelings that come from body budgeting gives you a lot of flexibility over how to cope with things on a day-to-day basis.
We know that climate change is occurring, and if we don't change our behavior, there will be serious consequences for life as we know it on this planet. But many can't grasp the immediacy of this problem. First, help us understand how our brains are shaping our lack of response to the climate emergency and maybe how we motivate people to take action.
Yeah, sure. In your mind's eye, can you imagine a red Macintosh apple of the sort that you would eat?
Of course.
Can you see it?
Yeah.
Most people can, right? You can see kind of a ghostly apple. And you can even hear, you know, the crunch of the apple as you bite into it and so on. And that's because your brain can change the firing of its own neurons. That's actually what predictions are. It's this really, really amazing thing that your brain can do. It can change the firing of its own neurons in the absence of sensory inputs. So you can hear a song, you know, that isn't there. Sometimes you can't even get it out of your head. We call this simulation. And we can imagine things that aren't there and actually see them. But we can't really do this for every sense equally. And so, for example, can you conjure up the feeling of pain that you felt? Like, think of the most painful thing that's ever happened to you. For me, it was childbirth. I'm aware that I was in pain, but I can't actually conjure the pain the way that I can conjure an apple in my mind or the way that I can hear a song going through my head. And this inability to simulate really distressing, unpleasant feelings, simulate them from the past, is related to our lack of action on climate change. People have a hard time simulating what life would be like under those circumstances. And so they're not, that simulation doesn't prevent them from doing bad things. There are so many steps between not recycling or leaving your lights on or driving, so many steps and such a long time between that and the consequences of major climate change that people have a hard time simulating and they have a hard time drawing those associations. But
about 30 seconds. Give us some insight in how we can.
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, one thing, one of the reasons I think why dystopian novels are so interesting right now and movies and is that it, you know, they're potentially helping people to imagine what life might be like if we don't change our behavior in a major way.
Yeah. Dr. Lisa Feldman-Barrett's neuroscientist, a university distinguished professor at Northeastern with research appointments at Harvard Medical School and Mass General Hospital. Her most recent book, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain, will have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Barrett, thanks so much for being with us this morning. We learned a lot.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.